We're seeing a flow of users using rollups because they're cheaper and more capital efficient. It just sort of speaks to what we might continue to see from these DeFi applications.
Get ready to jumpstart your week with the FCAT Crypto Brief, brought to you by Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. Every week, we roll up our sleeves and delve into the hottest topics, from blockchain breakthroughs to DeFi revolutions and market happenings. We promise to go deeper than the headlines and deliver insights you can't get just anywhere. Be sure to hit the subscribe button for your weekly dose of crypto commentary. Quick disclaimer, we're here for education, not investment advice. Views expressed are that of the hosts, not Fidelity or its affiliates. Crypto's a wild space, highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is strictly for those with a high risk tolerance. Buckle up, enjoy the ride, and let's dive into what's been happening recently.
So good morning, guys. Happy Valentine's Day.
Good morning.
Morning.
Yeah, love is in the air. Our love for crypto.
I was just thinking the same thing. So obviously we're recording this today on February 14th. We've got Jack, Gotham, and Max here with me, Jason, today. So we're going to do a rundown on some recent activities and a little bit of a dive into the upcoming Petra upgrade for Ethereum. But before we do this, one of the things we've talked about in the past is what have we tried recently? And Parth isn't with us this week, but have any of you guys tried anything interesting lately you'd like to share with the group?
Well, I did actually make my first trade on Unichain the other day, which is pretty exciting. Just had to test that out.
How was your bridging experience?
Luckily it was pretty easy. Honestly, I did it all like right within the Uniswap app. So it was pretty seamless. I didn't have to wait too long either.
So you said the app. So we're using a PC, not to dox your OPSEC, but PC UI integration, or were you doing something on mobile?
Yeah, I do it on mobile. I'm not too concerned.
Nice. Good for you. So we'll dive into stories in a minute, but I have to tell you guys a funny story. If I haven't before, and if I have, just know that I'll spend a lot of time in crypto and I can't remember what I've shared and what I haven't. But I recently had to sit down and explain Bitcoin and whether or not it should be purchased by my 96-year-old grandmother. So she was like, I know you do this stuff. I see this on TV now. She's like, should I buy it? I was like, Grandma, you're 90, 95, 96. Like, what's your time horizon? It was really funny. So anyways, I felt like if I could explain it to her and she walked away thinking it was something that she'd be interested in, it was probably a good explanation. But I highly recommend getting together. If you're fortunate enough to have seniors in your life, try to explain this stuff to them and then you'll know whether or not you really understand it.
I actually had a similar experience, and I had a lot of success relating it to gold, right? That's something a lot of, those generations really understand. But she couldn't get over the fact that, she couldn't hold it. So we're not quite there yet, but,
Yeah, it's funny. I think the one thing that I really take away from this, and I feel blessed to be able to have this conversation, is that this is someone who lived through the Great Depression. And they truly understand the value of a bearer instrument.
Right.
The challenge of it being digital and not tangible in terms of a physical demonstration is the hurdle. But anyways, we've got a lot to cover today. We're going to talk a bit about a recent filing by one of the U.S. exchange traded products offering Ethereum exposure. They want to bring in some additional yield to the product by allowing for staking. So they've made that application to the CBOE. We're going to talk a bit about the Petra upgrade. And then, Max, as you talked about, maybe you can share some of your experience with Uniswap Labs and the release of the Unichain on mainnet. So let's kick it off. Who would like to talk more about the CBOE filing?
I can intro it, and then we can chat about some of the implications. So the CBOE filed Form 19B4. Which is a filing from exchanges or self-regulatory organizations like FINRA to the SEC when investment products have certain changes that they want, and then the SEC can respond or let it happen. So there's some sort of like a time period between now and potentially this taking place. But CBOE filed for one of the ETH ETFs that's listed on its exchange to include staking capabilities for Ethereum, presumably inside of the ETF. And we won't know, you know, timing wise, if you do sort of back of the napkin math, depending on if and when they acknowledge it in the coming days or weeks, then you're looking at sometime the end of October, potentially as a deadline to hear back for this. Now, the SEC can respond before then, but historically, a lot of the action within crypto, which may be changing, was if they were going to approve something, they approved by, you know, sort of letting the time lapse. And then once the time lapsed, that was your go-ahead to be able to do it because they didn't say no for it. But anyways, this request comes alongside, you know, several filings from issuers themselves for assets to be included in ETFs like Solana, Litecoin, XRP, Dogecoin, a number of them. Other assets, right now we only have Bitcoin and Ethereum spot ETFs approved in the United States. So potentially, you know, the change in regulatory regime that's going on right now, a lot of people have believe that, you know, the SEC is going to become more crypto friendly. And I think there's reason to believe that given, you know, some of the people that are being appointed to relatively high positions in these regulatory agencies. And now on this front, with respect to proof of stake assets, this does feel like it could be pretty meaningful. If you own Ethereum spot yourself, you know, there's a clear incentive to stake it because there's an opportunity cost. Now, there are some risks that exist from staking your assets, and there's a lack of liquidity to some degree that exists when you choose to stake your assets, but you do earn compensation in return for those risks that you're bearing. And most people within crypto think that those risks are relatively small, at least to date. They've appeared, you know, to be relatively small if sort of done and managed right with the right partners. So yeah, I think this is sort of a big step for proof of stake assets if it does get approved. And I think there's reason to believe that a lot of these issuers would want to compete and make their products competitive with their peer set and to add staking capabilities inside of, you know, their products for proof of stake assets as well. There's a number of considerations that we can sort of get into of like ways that this could impact these products and stuff like that. But what do you guys think?
I think it's really interesting because you make the distinction here. This is an exchange that's filing for the or on behalf of a product that's traded on that exchange. If my memory is correct, prior to the Ethereum ETFs or ETPs being approved, many of the original applications had included provisions around staking. So this is really sort of a throwback, if you will, to what many had initially had hoped for in terms of how to design a product, right?
Yeah, so that I believe a number of the issuers had that language around being able to potentially stake assets inside of the fund. That language was struck out, and then everything that's been approved for, you know, the spot ETH ETPs that trade today, those all don't have the language around being able to stake the assets, and so they would presumably require these types of amendments. And now that we're, you know, looking at a new regime with sort of a different outlook on crypto, it appears, I think, you know, it's not crazy to believe that a number of these issuers would probably follow suit in line with this and try to be able to stake their assets inside of these funds. Obviously, whether or not it gets approved is a, you know, there's some sort of probability, but presumably these issuers and exchanges believe that probability is now greater than it was before.
But one of the things I was thinking about is, Jack, you talked about the products here. You're really talking about those that are available in the US, right? So there could be products that are offered outside of the US that do already allow for exposure to this yield generation through staking. So in some respects, if this were to be approved, this could normalize the playing field cross-border.
Yeah, absolutely.
Max, what do you think about this?
Yeah, I mean, at first glance, it definitely reminds me of the Kraken story we covered a few weeks ago, kind of just this re-entry into, or at least heading in the direction of, you know, being more inclined to stake those assets. My initial question is just how is this all going to work, right? Like, I'm really curious about the design that like these issuers are hoping to come up with. And I think there will be some variability, right? But the real question for me kind of hinges on the fact that there's not this like set amount of time that it takes for ETH to be unstaked, right? Like, there's this queue process, right? So you can't guarantee that, you know, if your clients try to redeem their shares that, hey, we'll have the assets to you in 2 days, or, you know, there's not the set amount of time. It all depends on how many other people are unstaking at that time, because there is just a limited number of ETH that can be unstaked on the protocol side within a certain amount of time. So definitely curious to see the different choices that they make. Do you have anything?
Yeah, I think it's a great observation. It'll be interesting to see how regulators think about this, as well as issuers, manage these types of risks? Because presumably, if you're directly staking the assets on behalf of the holders of the fund, you do run into this potential liquidity issue. That means that all of the ETH cannot feasibly be staked. Otherwise, you run the risk of basically the fund trading at, you know, at a discount relative to potentially the net asset value of the assets, because the person that's, you know, the market maker, the authorized participant of the ETF, the way that they work is if the ETF starts to trade below its net assets, there's an incentive for the authorized participant to step in and start redeeming for the underlying assets and actually selling them. So they'll go with shares to to the actual exchange, and they'll be able to create or redeem the assets when they trade out of line. But if you go to try to destroy shares and redeem them for the underlying basket of assets, but those basket of assets are ETH that is staked, that is waiting in a queue to unstake, that means that you can't actually access those assets in real time. Then the fund could trade at a discount until you're able to unstake those assets. So there's all these types of like weird liquidity risks that start to come up. It does make me start to think like, okay, well then who's going to be the first to launch an ETF that holds a basket or a single liquid staked version of Ethereum? Because that seems like that would be the next logical step to then be able to have, you know, potentially all of the assets staked because you have a redeemable token underneath it that is also liquid. I don't know when that will happen, but it does seem like a logical next step eventually.
Yeah. Part of me thinks that as an asset manager, you know, if they were to have the opportunity to provide these types of exposures, there would be some way to manage a buffer. And that's, again, speculation on my part, but knowing how other products work, it would seem reasonable that there'll be some degree of, I don't want to call it performance drag because it's not necessarily that. I think it'd be operational intent on how to manage what is generating yield versus what would be available for processing redemptions. But I think it'll be interesting to see if this does happen and where we go from here in terms of whether it's a liquid staking token or we have other spot products that are related to proof of stake assets and see what that trend may be.
And it's also really important for like even other assets if and when they get approved. So let's just use like Solana as the example. Solana has a higher like embedded inflation rate than Ethereum does. And so the opportunity cost of not staking assets is even higher. And so presumably if ETH staking was approved and then Solana spot ETFs were approved, people would try to get approved to stake those assets. And so I think it's also meaningful for those assets as well, even to a higher degree than Ethereum arguably.
Awesome. So since we're talking about all this, Gotham, I know you've done some work thinking about this Pectra upgrade, but just generally speaking, what are your thoughts on this one? And then maybe we can dive into a little bit, explain what Pectra means and how that might change the way that people think about running validators.
I guess in general, I would say that from an opportunity perspective, you know, the approval could pave the way for more, you know, crypto finance products to blend more with traditional decentralized elements. You know, I think it, you know, if we take a step back, it kind of simplifies the staking processes for like an average user. So removing the need for an individual wallet management, right? But again, as Jack and Max, and I think you all pointed out, you know, there's like regulatory hurdles that kind of remain, right? In terms of like, you know, labeling statements with labeling proof of stake tokens as securities, and then also just like the ruling in place of how you would do it. I would assume also there would be like a buffer in place, right, for that. But yeah, I think those would be my thoughts on that.
And I think like pretty interestingly, there's kind of a correlation here, right? Like talking about staking and then changes in staking coming up in the next upgrade. Yeah, Gotham, do you want to highlight kind of what that looks like?
Yeah, good transition, Max. So, so recently we have gotten news that we are getting scheduled testing for the Pectra upgrade. So scheduled testing for the Holesky net test work testnet on February 26th, and then the Sopella testnet on March 5th. So one of the core developers of the, you know, Ethereum Foundation, Tim Byko, had announced on Twitter that, you know, if the tests succeed, then the upgrade will potentially launch on mainnet, hopefully by April. And some of the upgrade improvements are quite interesting, actually. And I think it it kind of leans into a lot of really interesting discussions on where the Ethereum like network would go in the future. I think some of the big ones that I've noticed was EIP 7702, which is the account abstraction. To put it simply, it just enables wallets to, you know, have some smart contract capabilities. So let's say you wanted to pay for gas fees, you know, in tokens other than ETH, then you can technically do that with this EIP. You've also got EIP 7251, which is increasing the staking limit. So it raises the validator staking from 32 ETH to 2048 ETH. So it allows larger validators to kind of consolidate the operation and not streamline new node setups. So it makes it a little bit cheaper if you're instead of running multiple nodes with 32 ETH. And then the big one is the blob transactions with 7691. So it introduces like a fixed limit of 6 blocks. So it enhances the capacity for layer 2 rollups. But I'm curious to hear what everyone's thoughts is on these changes.
I mean, personally, I think the max effective balance we should probably double click into. It's not, I think the impacts just aren't really intuitive. It, like, as you mentioned, a clear improvement is to basically lower the operational costs for larger stakers or staking service providers, right? They can have more ETH on, you know, less boxes essentially, right? And so it might be able to cut costs there. That's kind of the initial reaction that a lot of people have. But on the other side, I think maybe an even more meaningful improvement to like network health is the benefits that it provides solo stakers. Like if you're running a validator at home, as of now, the both, again, the minimum and the maximum balance you can have is 32 ETH. So what happens when you have a balance greater than 32 ETH is it gets automatically withdrawn to you. So what if you wanted to continue earning rewards on those dollars that you just earned, what do you have to do? You have to wait until you have another 32 ETH to run another validator, or just go deposit those assets to some other provider, right? Like those are kind of the only options you have if, you know, you wanted to continue earning rewards on your excess balance. But now you can just keep as much ETH as you want as a solo staker on your validator and continue basically holding your proportion of the network alongside some of the larger players, which I think is really important.
You know, one of the things I think about with the maximum effective balance is really around network security, right? So we talk about validators being there to secure the network. You've got proposer and builder separation around blocks. So you've got these entities that build or compile the block, and then they put it out for the validator to propose to the network and for other validators to synchronize with and agree to in the form of consensus. You know, we talk about cost. You know, you might think that maybe there's a reduction in cost because you might run fewer boxes to run the validators. But one of the things that's interesting is your opportunities to win a block proposal, in theory, could be reduced because now you have a concentration on maybe a smaller number of validators. So I do wonder, I think sometimes is it cost or is it really about trying to project to the world that Ethereum is a less energy intensive blockchain because now you can ensure that security with a small number of validators. And, you know, as we were preparing, one of the things I found interesting, I think, Max, you may have mentioned it, the actual number of Ethereum validators may have recently contracted for the first time in a few years, because it has been a chart that is literally up and to the right for quite a while. And I think for many months, we had seen new all-time highs for the number of validators that are secure in the network. So any thoughts on what might have contributed to this near-term contraction?
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's hard to answer, you know, on the behalf of all the exiting validators specifically. It is very notable. It's something we called out in our signals report pretty recently, because this is the first quarter as a whole that we've seen an actual decrease in the active validator count on Ethereum since 2020, right? Since Beacon Chain was launched. So it's definitely notable. And like the intuitive answer for me is, hey, recent price action hasn't been great. So that has caused some, you know, validators to try to find returns elsewhere, right? That's the intuitive answer for me. The counter argument I keep running up against is, hey, like price has dropped by a lot from like since 2020, right? So like this isn't necessarily new. So I'm not sure, but maybe like the wider range of validators, you know, is I guess less aligned with Ethereum and just more looking for those returns, right? If you staked ETH in 2020, you were probably hardcore into the weeds and really set out for the long-term vision. Whereas, you know, now that we've got a more diversified kind of player pool here, it's really just opportunity cost calculations that everyone's running individually. Those are my initial thoughts. Probably has to do something with price. I'm not convinced it's like the coming upgrade necessarily. I wouldn't say it adds significantly more risk to validators themselves.
Yeah, we did see a day with about a 20% pullback a couple of weeks ago. We had one of those back in July as well. And if my memory is correct, we didn't really see a decrease in the number of validators. So I think you're spot on to say that it's really hard to pinpoint. All we can look for are correlations as opposed to causation.
Yeah, yeah. These drops are not uncommon. You know, anyone that's been in the industry kind of knows this. I can't help but wonder if it's the recent discussions around like the staking cap that have maybe spurred some validators to look elsewhere as well, right? Like there's nothing technically confirmed. It's all just kind of discussions and forums between researchers. But the idea is to cap the staking ratio through this like yield curve, right? So the more validators there are on the network, the lower each individual validator yield is. And they're essentially like some developers and researchers are talking about potentially changing the curves to prevent the total amount of stake from reaching some threshold, right? Which is different than what it is now. Could be some validators reading the tea leaves of that coming in the future, but there's nothing confirmed yet.
Yeah. And when you talk about the total of Ethereum that's staked, we did a quick scan before this for this episode, and we're sitting around 27-28% of all Ethereum in circulation right now is currently staked. So a large portion of that is in Lido, which is the liquid staking protocol. So I think roughly 30% of staked ETH is in that protocol. So, one of the things that I was just thinking about, as you said, you know, the opportunity to generate yield. I've had the question posed to me, well, if we increase the maximum effective balance for a validator, if I have more quote unquote value at risk on a validator, do I get a higher payout when I get a block proposal? And the short answer to that is no. You know, you will get the block proposal, whatever transaction fees are associated with it, whether it's 32 ETH staked to a validator or 2048, the reward is in fact the same nominal value because that is what the network is paying for that block.
That's a really good point. And a lot of discussion has been kind of focused on like what the incentives are actually for larger validators to consolidate, because as you said, like the nominal reward doesn't change, but the risk that they're taking on each single validator does increase, right? They had to adjust the penalties that would be put on each validator for getting slashed, right? It's no longer a limit of all the ETH, which was 32. Now it goes up to 2048. So it seems like the risks have slightly moved up, but the rewards haven't. So it's honestly a question of like what the incentives are and how many validators like will be moving or consolidating their ETH here.
Yeah. So Gotham, what do you think? Should we come back and revisit this sometime, assuming Petra gets upgraded, and you know, look back a year from now and see what happened?
Definitely, Jason. Yeah, I'm really curious to see, especially once we go through, like once it goes through the testing phases, like what they find. And then once we get close to the mainnet, it'll be a really fun discussion to talk about.
Cool. Maybe we can we come back to that one in a bit, but let's talk a little bit about Unichain launching on mainnet, because that's also somewhat related to capacity in block space, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely been a hot topic of discussion in terms of how new layer twos and existing layer twos that are looking to increase their throughput are all going to fit on kind of the fixed supply of blobs that Ethereum offers. As Gotham mentioned, the Petra upgrade is going to double the like average number of blobs per block from 3, which is current, to 6 blobs per block. So doubling the capacity of data, right? And that's what layer twos use Ethereum for, to post their transactions to these blobs, or just, you know, storage components to Ethereum. So, right, that brings us to the Unichain launch, which is brand new L2 using the OP stack. And personally, when I read the initial article, I was less I was more enthusiastic about the roadmap that they laid out, because right now it looks quite similar to a lot of the other general purpose rollups, right? You have 2 second block times and a centralized single sequencer, right? So it's not too different right now. But the roadmap was quite, I guess, unique, and they're working with Flashbots and OP Labs, I think, on a few initiatives, one of which is Rollup Boost, which, Jason, as you mentioned earlier, actually inserts builders into the Layer 2 ecosystem officially, right? So the idea is to have a market of builders to build blocks for Layer 2s. And that has a number of enhancements, one of which is really important for Unichain, which is like sub-second block times, to just be able to provide really fast execution for user trades and hopefully get better pricing for them. I don't know if you thought anything else was interesting, but that definitely stood out to me as like a notable change from like the other roadmaps that I've seen Layer 2s come out with.
Yeah, I actually really like the idea of like the Unichain using the rollup boost. Just to clarify, the rollup boost is basically like a block building system developed in, as you mentioned, in collaboration with Flashbots. And the idea is like you'd split the blocks into sub-blocks and kind of achieve this sub-second block time. So, you know, roughly targeting that, you know, 250 millisecond per like sub-block. So thereby you're kind of like reducing the MEV by limiting the window of the transaction order, which is pretty cool. It's definitely interesting to see in terms of like the performance and where things are going with that.
So breaking down what you guys just discussed, and Jack, I definitely want to get your take on this too, but to overly simplify, what I think I'm hearing is that there is a place where things settle, and that is the main chain. And there can be a place where things happen, which is an upper level L2 type stack, but we can make things happen faster at the level 2 because of these technology proposals. And in doing so, we're going to make transactions less susceptible to any type of value extraction. Is that fair?
That's pretty spot on, Jason. To add some more complexity to your oversimplified version there, I think there's an additional benefit that maybe might get overlooked here, but a lot of the kind of discussion around L2s is, hey, we have this one sequencer that's in charge of transaction ordering and to ensure that the data gets posted to Ethereum, right? So the whole idea of creating a marketplace instead of this one sequencer is to kind of spread out that single point of failure, right? Reduce the role of this centralized sequencer that is common in the L2 design now, right? You could think of a simple example where if you have one single sequencer and it goes down, users are, you know, kind of out of luck, right? But if you have a marketplace of builders kind of all working to do the same role, there's, again, just less reliance on a single actor here, both on the MEV side, right, and on the liveness or just keeping the chain functioning side. So I think that's important.
Any thoughts on this one?
Yeah. I was just going to take it like a little higher level for 1 second, maybe here towards the end. And, you know, it's just interesting. Like we talk about roll up future for Ethereum, Uniswap obviously being one of the poster childs of like blue chip DeFi protocols that has, you know, it lives on other chains. It lives on a lot of these roll ups as well, but primarily has been used on base layer Ethereum. And we've seen like a lot of traction from like Aerodrome, for example, which is on base. It's sort of like the de facto DEX that people are using on base. And it's super cheap because you pay transaction fees on base and not on Ethereum. So we're seeing like a flow of, you know, users using rollups because they're cheaper and more capital efficient. And now Uniswap, you know, obviously creating its own rollup here just sort of speaks to like what we might continue to see from these DeFi applications, from, you know, take it to lending protocols. And I think of like Maker and Aave and sort of what's next for those guys. Like, will we continue to see these types of things? It seems like that's the trend within Ethereum, is applications incentivized to create their own rollups. The question is, how integrated and interoperable can these things be versus being like fragmented islands that are hard to get to and from? That will ultimately, I think, define how Ethereum forges ahead versus a Solana that's, you know, obviously more monolithic.
So I know we're at time, but Jack, I think I just heard you subtly suggest that, you know, we've had the block size wars in the past, or we headed towards the roll-up wars.
Yeah, I think that's maybe a good way to frame it.
All right. Well, great conversation today, guys. I really appreciate you guys sharing your thoughts on these topics. We'll stay tuned and we'll come back a year from now and figure out what happened if and when Pectra went into place.
That's great. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
Crypto as an asset class is highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is for investors with a high risk tolerance. Crypto may also be more susceptible to market manipulation than securities. Crypto is not insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Investors in crypto do not benefit from the same regulatory protections applicable to registered securities. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. This podcast was produced by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, also known as FCAT. FCAT does not offer digital assets nor provide clearing or custody of such assets. It is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide tax, legal, insurance, or investment advice, and should not be construed as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to buy, or a recommendation for any security or other asset by any Fidelity entity or third party. Views expressed are as of the date indicated, based on the information available at the time, and may change based on market or other conditions. Unless otherwise noted, the opinions provided are those of the authors and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. Fidelity does not assume any duty to update any of the information. Fidelity and any other third parties mentioned in the podcast are independent entities and are not affiliated. Mentioning them does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information is not intended for distribution to or use by any person or entity in any jurisdiction or country where such distribution or use would be contrary to local law or regulation. Persons accessing this information are required to inform themselves about and observe such restrictions. Third-party trademarks appearing herein are the property of their respective owners. All others are the property of FMR LLC. Copyright 2025 FMR LLC. All rights reserved. 1040156.